So why don't you just start by introducing yourself? Who are you? What do you do?
Okay, I'm Adrienne Wheeler. I'm a visual artist, independent curator, organizer of exhibitions. I work here at Rutgers Paul Robeson Galleries as an artist educator. I, for the last few years, have been the lead curator for the Newark Arts Festival. I'm a daughter. My mom is 94. I'm a mother. My daughter is 33. I have a sister, two nieces, a great nephew. That's my immediate clan.
And where do you come from, and how did you get here?
I was born here. I was born here in Newark, New Jersey. And on the Wheeler side of my family, I am one of many, many generations going back a little over 200 years to have been born in and lived in the city of Newark.
Wow. So did you ever live anywhere aside from Newark?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've lived in East Brunswick, Montclair, Boston.
What brought you back here?
Well, after school I came back, and then I started working in the city.
Mm-hmm. Are there any physical spaces here in Newark that you feel more deeply connected to?
Lots of them.
Can you pick a few?
Yeah,
and
I took the bus here, so I actually rode past a lot of them. Probably besides my own home, you know, which is the house I live in now, my grandmother's house, which is on Washington Street. And I tell people, this is my paternal grandmother, and I tell people that when I was born, when my parents brought me home from the hospital, it was my mother, my father, my grandmother, and me. And she came to our house every day from the time I was born until I was in high school. And when it was too much for her to come to the house, we went to her house. My sister and I went to her house every day and waited, you know, for my mom to pick us up.
Mm-hmm. Was she also a born and raised?
She was born in Newark in 1896. So one of the other, you know, I think when I think in terms of place, I think more in terms of buildings. Like, I've always been attracted to architecture. Architecture and objects, you know, even as a small child. And I know that partially from memory, but also from things that people have said and from things that I've inherited because I was attached to them as a child or made remarks about them when I was a child, so.
Do you remember any of those stories?
Well, there is a platter that belonged to my great-grandmother that my grandmother gave me because she used it every Easter, and she said every Easter I would just talk about how much, how pretty it was and how much I liked it. So it was just a plain white English ironstone platter. And then there are a set of dishes that my aunt through marriage gave me for the same reason that she said whenever they had a dinner, you know, I would always remark about the plates and how pretty I thought they were. And I'm like, gee, I wonder if that was like some con I had going. I would just identify an object and talk about it with the hopes that I might get it someday.
Well, it works.
But yeah, it seemed to have worked. But buildings. So there was my grandmother's house on Washington Street. And her house faces Longworth Street. I mean, literally, you could just drive straight down and through that front building, front door. But her room was on the third floor, and there was a cuckoo clock, like an antique cuckoo clock that had belonged to her mother. And her grandmother was German, so there were a lot of things that were attached to Germany in some way. You know, her sister spoke German, my grandmother's sister was fluent in German. That cuckoo clock was like from the Black Forest. You know, it was hand carved, and you know she'd had it all that time. But there are other visuals. Like at night, when the cars rode by, the lights from the cars would cast a shadow from the blinds that would move across the wall, and I love that. I mean, I think about it all the time, and I even. In photography I've done and video, I've done a lot of images of either my shadow or shadows of bicycles. I just really love shadows. Mm-hmm. There's something otherworldly in them. Mm-hmm. And then another building would be
Grace Episcopal Church, which is on the northeast corner of Broad Street, right across from the federal building. But it's the church that my grandmother and all of her siblings were christened in, like in 1896 and earlier. I think she had a brother that was some years older, and then a few other siblings who were younger. And I've actually gone into that church. I've gone into that church twice, both times as an adult. My nephew graduated from North Boys Chorus School, and they had their graduation there. But I actually went in to look at the archives, and they brought out the original books, and I was able to see her baptismal records and the baptismal records of all of her siblings. And it gave me information like on who her godparents were, or at least the witnesses that stood up with her parents when she was christened. And then, you know, this Wheeler project that I've been working on, where I am using primarily census documents and looking at the addresses. And then I've been going around and either videotaping the walks or actually photographing whatever is present in that, where that address is. So sometimes it's a retaining wall, or it is a retaining wall. I'm almost across from where the mural is. On 1 and 9 as you're going south, like the very south end of Broad Street. Others, the original house still stands. There's some where the address is the same, but the building is not the same. Mm-hmm. There are places where it's just a vacant lot. I've gone into the firehouse in the Ironbound. One grandparent was born on Vesey Street and the other one on Green Street. And both of those streets, they were born on the other side of the railroad tracks, mm-hmm. literally on the east side of the railroad tracks. And there's even a street, Wheeler Point Road, and a lot of the family lore says that that property belonged to us. So I've since been into the New Jersey Historical Society, and I was able to, in trying to find out, it all started trying to find out when that street was named, you know, because my grandfather's sister said that that property had belonged to us and that her father had sold it off, you know, bit by bit. My father and all of his brothers grew up with that story. So we've been down there. We've climbed ladders pointing to the sign and taken pictures. When my cousins from California have come out, they've taken pictures. Since I've started this project, I've gone back and taken pictures. I have the images and maps and documents that I saw in the New Jersey Historical Society lead to a Caleb Wheeler who came down the Hudson, came down from Connecticut into the Newark Bay and landed in that property. That ended up his property, however he acquired it, but with Robert Treat. So, you know, we're going back. Yeah. Now, I don't know that we have any connection to Caleb, except that it is the exact same piece of land.
And it's a Wheeler.
And it's Wheeler, right. And he's Caleb Wheeler. And then it was called Wheeler's Point. But my family lived down there. Like, they didn't live on that street because, for the most part, it even looks now like it was probably pretty uninhabitable then because when you walk all the way down, you find the railroad tracks. And then my oldest first cousin said that her dad told her that at some point that property stretched out to where the original part of the airport was. So what is, I think, the north terminal, you know, or what would be the northernmost part of the airport. So, and there are no buildings there that I know of. There are no addresses, you know, on Wheeler Point Road, but there are addresses on Oliver Street and Green Street and Vesey Street and all of these other streets in that area where either my grandmother's family or on the Wheeler side, my father's grandparents lived. And what we now know is University Place, there's a document where my great-grandmother, who was Mary Jane Whitfield before she married my great-grandfather, who was Robert Wheeler. She lived and worked in that document. It says that her her occupation was servant. And then you fast forward after she's married, and it took me a long time to figure out what that occupation said. And then finally I was able to see it, and it said wash and iron. And then I kind of had this sense that, well, there's some independence in that, there's agency in that, you know, that somehow or other, this is her business. You know, it's her livelihood, and I'm sure she was getting next to nothing. But she wasn't a servant mm-hmm. in someone's house. So, and I've done print work with that particular document, mm-hmm. and it's actually called Wash and Iron. Arts High School, that's a building that I recently photographed because my dad went to Arts High School. One of his older brothers went to Central High School, but then he studied, I guess it was post-secondary, at the Newark School of Fine and Industrial Arts mm. and then taught there. Mm. So that's like another building that's important. And then probably the second most remembered building for me, or third beside the house we live in my grandmother's house, would be the church where my parents were married and where my sister and I were both christened. And that was on Mercer Street. So if you know where Perry's funeral home is on Mercer Street, just before High Street or MLK, it would have been to the right. And it was that very typical Gothic architecture. And I don't know what church occupied it before Israel Memorial AME had it. But it was a church I knew as a child. You know, it was, I remember the Sunday school room and, you know, what the inside of the church looked like. And it had, that church had two levels. So there was, I guess, what's technically a balcony. And a lot of kids, we would go up to the balcony because there was a short period of time between Sunday school and when church service actually started. So, you know, kids were kind of allowed to roam a little freely. And then I had cousins that also attended the church, and we would, after Sunday school, sneak out of church and run up Springfield Avenue to the candy store, and we'd take our money that was supposed to go in the basket for church, and we'd spend it on candy. And, you know, the whole idea was to be able to get to the candy store, get the candy, and get back to church before service started and anyone noticed that we were missing. Yeah, but, and then that church, what I really remember, I mean, that's a good memory, but the church burned on, like, I think it was like New Year's Day or New Year's Eve night. It was sometime like during the holiday, and I can remember, I know it was before 1967, you know, and that's the other thing. I buildings and experiences in Newark are divided for me because I was 10 during the rebellion. So there's the Newark that I knew prior and the Newark that I knew after. And then, of course, there are so many of the buildings that I would have remembered that ceased to exist. You know, they were lost by fire or just torn down. Yeah. You know, or just left to urban blight. But, so the church burned. And there was another building that I was just thinking about. Oh, Bamberger's. Oh, yeah. Yeah, Bamberger's, because my mother worked there, and she was a junior executive for the furniture buyer. So it was like a big deal, you know, that a black woman had that position. And a black woman, and it's important also, her complexion. Mm. You know, because the majority of black women that worked in Bamberger's at that time, especially like if they were visible, you know, the operator elevators, they almost looked white. Mm. You know, they were so, my grandmother had one sister that did work as an elevator operator because she was so light. They thought she was white. She didn't pass, but they thought she was. And then she had another sister that was so dark, they wouldn't hire her to do anything in the store. So my mom was like either the first or one of the first black women to have that executive position. And I just, that store, we did everything there. We got everything there. Our piano came from there. Our furniture came from there. My brownie uniform came from there. You know, my first bra came from there. All of our clothes, clothes for summer camp. We took pictures with Santa Claus there. The Easter Bunny was there. They once had a llama incidentally, who was named Lydia, and you know that's my sister's name. So that was a big deal when we went to visit Lydia the llama.
And,
yeah, everything, and just, and that the office, like her office, you know, it was like all the mahogany paneled walls and it's a huge desk. I mean, it was really, really impressive.
Did you know how impressive it was at that time?
Not as I do now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew, like, visually it was impressive, mm-hmm. you know, and I, because there were always conversations, you know, around race and, let's see, I started kindergarten in 1962. Mm-hmm. So we were only like so many years past Emmett Till, mm-hmm. you know, Voting Rights Amendment. So there, you know, my family, they were active politically. So there were always conversations. Mm-hmm. I mean, families were, even the houses of other families on my block, because at a time when they were redlining and redistricting mm-hmm. schools, the parents were having meetings, mm. and one of those parents was our former congressman, Donald Payne Sr. Mm. He was a young school teacher and parent. You know, he's younger than my parents, but he and the Thompsons and my family, the Parhams, the Washingtons, you know, all of those families, they were meeting, for, you know, they would hold a meeting in one house, they would hold a meeting in another house, and they were talking about, you know, this redistricting because they were still trying to keep certain schools as white as they could, and then shifting. I mean, I went to three different schools, well, two different schools for kindergarten. I went to one school for one day. That was Bergaugh, and I think that was actually my parents' choice. And then they somehow or other, the school district said, no, she's not supposed to be there. She's supposed to be in Hawthorne Avenue School. So I went there. And then the next year, there was another redistricting. Mm-hmm. And I went to Peschine Avenue School. And then after that, I went to, my sister and I went to private school. Now that's a building that I love. That building is now the North Ward Cultural Center on Mount Prospect Avenue. But it was Prospect Hill Country Day. Mm. And before that, it was the Clark, the thread company, Coates and Clark. It was the Clark Mansion. So the factory owner, the thread factory owner. And it was a replica of a Scottish castle. Whoa. So, you know, there were like rooms all over. And there's a picture, obviously yearbook pictures and things like that. And then, you know, there are all these kind of rituals where you get presented with the senior seat, and you know, there's the moving up ceremonies from lower school to middle school to upper school. And some of those things would take place at the school, and then others, there was a Presbyterian church that, you know, we would go to, and then the glee club. So there's just all of these rooms. I just remember all of the rooms, and in drama club, like there was a wardrobe room.
Cool.
Yeah, and our, like, one year when we did Spoon River Anthology, and I was Lydia Puckett and another character who was an optometrist. Anyway, so that all of these things are, you know, there's just so much attached to buildings.
Yeah.
And parks. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. Because my grandmother walked. I mean, mm-hmm. we walked everywhere, every day. She would walk my sister in the stroller up to pick me up from kindergarten, and then we would walk almost downtown, mm-hmm. or we would get the bus and then go to her house and walk downtown more. Mm-hmm. But Weequahic Park, which is the park in the South Ward, the area, the Weequahic section of Newark, where I grew up and where I currently live, but there are these beautiful gazebos. And I just thought, you know, it was like being in some sort of, I don't know, like in a storybook, in a fairy tale. You know, you read all of these stories as kids, and I lived in, even now, when I read, a successful book for me is the one where I feel like I've become part of the story, where I envision myself somewhere in that space where I can feel it and smell it. Mm-hmm. And that's how I used to feel with the, in the gazebos, you know, you just kind of, and then there were swings. I love swings. Even now, you know, I
even
love swings.
Even now?
Yeah.
I think as an adult, I get, like, nauseated being on swings now.
I think it's great. And, you know, Boomy moved into a great
building, oh my God, in Philadelphia, Alden Park. Mm-hmm. But on the grounds there, they have a swing. So when she first moved in, that was like one of the highlights when I went to visit her. Yeah, so a lot with buildings.
Were you always aware of how much history that you had here in the city?
Well, yes, because my father talked incessantly about the Wheelers and, you know, our presence in the city of Newark. And I think that's why, well, I don't think, I know that that's not, that that's why we didn't leave Newark. Because I know when the schools were really starting to deteriorate. My mother started looking at houses in, you know, suburbs of Newark, or what would be considered suburbs of Newark, South Orange, Maplewood, Montclair. And I remember my, I remember a conversation between my parents, and I remember my father saying, you can look at whatever you want, but know that I'm not going to live somewhere where I have to sit armed on my porch, hold a shotgun, for fear that someone is going to burn a cross on my lawn or that they're going to harm my children in some way. So the compromise was private school. So that's how that happened. Which was, and that was a difficult decision too, because both of my parents really believe in public education. So it was a hard fraught decision for them.
Yeah. So you were school age, you were young, a young child, like you said, when a lot of Emmett Till, the rebellion.
Well, that was before I was born. Yeah.
Oh,
but
okay.
But living it politically, living in the aftermath of it, like those are the things that inform the time in which I was born. So things that people would be talking about or, you know, all of the assassinations, the Newark Rebellion. I mean, even the death of singers and things like that. Like, I remember when Dinah Washington died. You know, she's a African-American blues singer, jazz singer, vocalist, song stylist, whatever the titles are. And it's, you know, it's an interesting thing in Black culture that this sense of kinship, you know, that we often have with entertainers, or, you know, when somebody would come on television, like the phone would start ringing, you know, it's like this phone chain. Oh, so-and-so is on the Ed Sullivan show, or this one is on, you know, whatever show there might be. And then where there were a few instances where, like, Nat King Cole and a few other African Americans actually had their own shows, very briefly, but they had them. So, you know, when Dinah Washington died, I just remember, and I was a kid, I mean, really young, but I can just remember hearing them say, oh my God, Dinah's dead. But I didn't know who Dinah was. I was like, Dinah?
Like, is that an auntie?
Yeah, like,
someone from church?
I've never seen her, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then my dad actually went to school with Sarah Vaughan.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they graduated from Miller Street Elementary School together.
Oh, my goodness.
And I have his elementary school autograph book, and her autograph is there.
No way.
Yeah, her autograph is there. And then I have an autograph picture when she was visiting Bamberger's when my mom was working there, and I was just a few months old.
Oh, my goodness.
And she, you know, inscribed that to me. Yeah, I know.
A lot of history, yeah. But your parents kept you well informed about what was going on politically?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, you know, I had aunt and uncle. My aunt was, Irene Wheeler, the sculptor. But they were socialist communists. So, you know, after the war, well, that's a story. So Uncle Herb would be 10, would have been 10 years older than my dad, and there were five boys. My father was the youngest of five boys, and then there was a brother right before him, Uncle Jim, and he was the last one to die, and he lived the longest. He was in his 90s. But at any rate, when they were kids, Uncle Herb had just joined the Communist Party and was, like, very active and involved, so he made arrangements for my father and Uncle Jim to go away to summer camp. But my grandparents didn't know they were going away to a communist summer camp. But what ended up happening is that, at least in my father's case, that it was a record that followed him.
Oh, that he went to this camp?
Right, that he had gone to this camp.
As a child?
As a child, yeah. And then, you know, because when you get to the era of McCarthy and,
you know, was just so, didn't stop him from going into the Army. The Army took him.
Right.
But he couldn't get like a job at the post office, like civil servant, those kinds of things, because he had that trail. But on a different note, when Paul Robeson was scheduled to speak and perform in Peekskill, there were race riots that, well, they knew that there were going to be issues. So they put a call out in the tri-state area, you know, for people to come up and form sort of a human shield to protect him. So my father, and this was right after, this was post-World War II, because my dad and Uncle Jim were out of the service. So my father, Uncle Jim, my father's oldest brother, and Uncle Herb, so four of them, drove up to Peekskill. And when they got there, the race riots had sort of erupted, and their car was stoned. And my uncle was hit in the head, Uncle Jim was hit in the head, and they wouldn't treat him in a hospital there. So they had to drive back to Manhattan, get him stitched up, and then they drove back to Peekskill, you know, for whatever else needed to be done. And then I think that that performance was, it took place, but it was rescheduled. So there was always, I mean, and those things happened before I was born, but those were stories that I grew up with. So I guess, you know, when people talk about when they were politicized, I guess I was born sort of politicized.
Yeah.
And then, of course, oh, and it's another house. Now, the house that Mr. and Mrs. Jones, Amiri Baraka's parents, own the house down the street from me. So his daughters, Kelly and Lisa, and his former wife, Hetty, lived in that house. So I saw them, and they were younger than me, so they primarily played with my sister and Pam, one of our neighbors. But yeah, those, so all of those
so
things
intertwined,
were, yeah, part of my upbringing.
So when you saw the report of the HLLC dig and all the artifacts and things that came out of there, you being a person who's very interested in the history of work and objects and things like that, what was your reaction to that?
Well, first, I mean, just to, I mean, again, visually, to see how it's archived photographically and how it's archived just in terms of the document itself. It was, some things were like really eerie, you know, when you're looking at just like coffin pieces, again, like these fragments. Yeah. And then, so, you know, it's like this thinking of sherds or fragments.
Yeah. Can you talk about what a sherd is?
Yes. A sherd is a shard. A shard, all shards are not sherds, but all shards are shards. So I think in the academic world or the world of archaeology, sherd is the preferred word when you are excavating fragments of things, glass, pottery. But I think mostly pottery. Yeah, as part of an architectural, archaeological dig. Yep.
So seeing all of those things laid out in the documentation.
Right, and that document came either while I was in South Carolina or right after I got back. So I'm like, oh my God, you know, this, here's this document. Here I am with all of these shards.
Yeah. Can you talk about what you're doing in South Carolina?
Yes. So Ade Bumi Badebo, as you know, is my art daughter. she is one of five contemporary artists, along with Simone Lee, Theaster Gates, and Woody D. Othello. So the exhibition is currently at the Met, and it's called Hear Me Now, The Black Potters of Old Edgefield. So Old Edgefield, South Carolina, where Stony Bluff Pottery Manufactory, as they were calling it then, which, but it was actually a plantation. So it's about Dave called different things, Dave, Dave Drake, Dave the Potter. So they've all responded in some way to the ceramics. And as I said, Bumi was included in that exhibition, and she had been, she'd already been doing work in South Carolina around her own family's history in enslavement and the plantation on which they were enslaved. And in Columbia, South Carolina, there is the McCord House that I think is currently owned either by the governor or one of the universities, but her ancestors physically built that. So the contractor has given her fragments mm-hmm. of the building, mm-hmm. you know, architectural pieces. So I was in South Carolina. I flew down there to meet Bumi because she had two vehicles and she needed to return one to North Carolina and then drive the other one from South Carolina back to New Jersey. So I went to help drive mm-hmm. and I ended up sort of doing my own mini dig and collecting of shards, fragments mm-hmm. of pots that were made by enslaved potters on Stony Bluff Plantation. You know, so we were able to see, I mean, when you're on the land itself, there's like a steep grading of land that just goes down. It's about 100 feet or more down. Mm-hmm. That was the kiln.
Oh, wow.
And the figures are staggering in terms of the numbers of pots that would be produced in a month. And I don't want to misquote the numbers, so Bumi could probably, I'm sure, can fill you in on that. But it's staggering. Mm. I have one fragment, and it has a fingerprint, and the print is so small, and it's so disturbing because it looks to me like a child's finger. Because when I put my own fingers in it, it's like my pinky finger fits perfectly. Mm. And you know, working with clay or to pinch a pot or to pinch a handle, you wouldn't be using your pinky. Mm. So that was either, you know, a very small woman, mm-hmm. probably, or a child. But either way, it's very disturbing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That object just holding all the power of the history.
Holds all of that history and all of that. The spirits of those people, the DNA of mm-hmm. the enslaved.
So you had just, like you said, experienced this sort of thing.
Right.
the shards in South Carolina, and then seeing this report of all this other old stuff.
Yeah, and I had sort of forgotten when they discovered that cemetery, when they were excavating the land mm-hmm. to build the HLLC building. Mm-hmm. So then it kind of throws you into that space of thinking about like cemeteries and how many cemeteries have been disrupted in order to build something. I mean, the Parkway is a prime example. You know, on both sides of the Parkway, there's a cemetery. Mm-hmm. There are multiple cemeteries, you know, all the way up, say, from Irvington as far up as like Upper Bloomfield, because mm-hmm. I know my grandfather and other relatives are buried there. But you know that they had to have disrupted graves, to just bulldoze through.
Right.
And you know, what that means when you're thinking of your own mortality mm-hmm. and what your wishes are for your own remains and mm-hmm. like, oh God, am I going to be buried? And then like 40 years from now, there's going to be some developer that just comes through and plows and just disturbs everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And how the landscape changes so much. And if you're a part of the landscape and they take that and move it somewhere else.
Yeah. And then, you know, when in reading where there's like pieces of a burial shroud, you know, and how does a burial shroud, like, what happened? Like, was there grave robbing? Because the shroud is on the person. They're supposed to be enclosed mm-hmm. and safe and, you know, far enough.
Yeah, how did it get out?
I guess 6 feet under is not far. We know it's not far enough.
Yeah,
you know, and then it just makes you think of, is the African burial ground in New York and mm-hmm. how, when the federal building, and I'm sure I'm not clear on all the details, but they had to halt that. Mm-hmm. And all of those remains were dug up, sent to Howard University. They were examined and tested for DNA, mm-hmm. and then they were reinterred, and then there is an actual memorial. So I guess then that brings us to other kinds of structures and buildings and monuments and how we're rethinking, mm-hmm. you know, monuments and who these monuments should memorialize.
Yeah.
You know, so you have the University of Virginia that's just done a memorial. Mabel O. Wilson was the architect, you know, who designed it, but it was designed to memorialize the enslaved Africans and African Americans on that campus. Mm. I mean, Rutgers University has its own history of enslavement. And then you wonder, you know, that's the other thing. And I guess I tended to look at the pieces that were older mm-hmm. because I'm just drawn to those things. I mean, I love antiques. I was actually in the antique business at one time. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of fragments and, you know, details and locks and hinges, and they hold great interest for me. But mm-hmm. at the same time, when you're thinking in terms of a cemetery, you know, just like that was not the first disrupting of that space.
Right.
You know, yeah. to be finding like shrouds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pieces.
Pieces.
When it should have
yeah,
been.
Yeah, intact. There are things that should have been intact had that been a first disrupting of the space.
Right.
So, yeah. you know, it just...
Hairpins.
Yeah. Nails, the dental...
What are the dental plates?
Right.
Oh, gosh.
Right, yeah.
Yeah,
you know, and
things.
Then, of course, there's the stuff, like, just everyday plastic mm-hmm. stuff that was thrown away. But then there was, like... And then it's a timeline.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're looking at Bakelite. Bakelite was produced at a particular period,
mm-hmm.
you know, than just regular old plastics. And mm-hmm. you even think about... the environmental issues mm-hmm. around plastic and how this stuff has just become part of the land.
Yeah.
And it doesn't disintegrate. Like, that's when you really see what is biodegradable and what is not.
That's true.
You know, that these things just go nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, and then you rethink what has been done to the planet, you know, because this damage is, it's done. You know, there's no... there's no turning back the clock, so it's just a matter of what do we do not to mm-hmm. Further danger, you know, the planet and yeah. our immediate environments.
When they do an archaeological dig 10,000 years from now, they're just going to find a lot of plastic.
I know. It's crazy. I mean, all the landfill, I mean,
shopping
how close
bags
we live to...
plastic spoons, yeah.
To the landfill.
Yeah. Okay, well, let me just
That's
ask you one mm-hmm. more question.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that you live with your mother, who is mm-hmm. 94, and mm-hmm. your daughter, Nadira, who's 33. So mm-hmm. you are kind of like the middle generation
I'm
in your
nobody
household.
Now.
You're nobody now, huh?
No, really. I mean,
yeah,
when I look
that?
At the space that I've occupied in terms of hierarchy in my lifetime, like, I'm the oldest child. I'm the first child.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
On my dad's side, there are two sets of us.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the first four grandchildren. Then there's like this 14, 15-year gap, and then me. And I have one cousin that just talks about, oh, you know, how everyone was anticipating my arrival. You know, it was like, oh, my God, a baby in the family. My grandmother was supposed to spend the winter in California, and she wouldn't stay after December. I was born in March, and my dad was her youngest son, and she was just not going to miss, you know, my birth. So I grew up with those stories.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then... Well, I was an aunt before I was a mom. And then you become a mother. And then everyone's attention is on, you know, the baby or the yeah. babies, the nieces.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, that my mother is aging and I'm aging as well. You know, and my mother is fascinated. She's like, wow, are you really that old?
Yes, Ma, sorry, you're
yeah,
older.
And Nadira is fast approaching middle age. I mean, she's got some gray hairs. And she's, you know, she has formed her own relationship with her grandmother because she recognized, I think, pretty early on after we moved back to the house. Well, she, because she grew up, she, Nadira, grew up in Montclair. So when we moved there, not to Montclair, but back to my home, she did a really quick analysis and figured out what the real hierarchy was, and that I wasn't the big wig that I'd led her to believe. Uh-huh. So she made an alliance with my mother. And that's how they function now.
Yeah.
You know, my mother relies on Nadira for everything. She calls her for everything because she doesn't want to, because for us, often these conversations are contentious.
For you and your mother.
For us, mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, like, you have to get up. You can't stay in the bed. Mm. You have to eat. You can't do this. So it's like on one level, I've become this sort of parental figure mm-hmm. for a person who's not budging and is going to make it very clear to me that she, in fact, is the parent mm. and not me. Mm. I mean, I threatened to call emergency and EMS, and she'll say things like, and when they get there, who's going with them? You? Or I suggested that we get a home health aide. She said, get one for yourself. And you know my mom. You
I
know,
do.
She's very pleasant. And she's yeah. pleasant in all of this. Mm-hmm. You know, she's never cantankerous. She's, you know, she's not, there's no bitterness. She, even when we're at the doctor's office, and then that's the other thing, like she's a celebrity in the doctor's office. You know, the doctor's saying things like, you know, I just really want you to know what an honor it is for me to be your physician. And then she wants to know what my mother attributes, you know, her longevity to. And of course, you know, she says, because she is a religious person, a deeply religious person, you know, that she attributes it to the fact that she's blessed, you know, mm-hmm. that this is her blessing, and that mm-hmm. she's surrounded by family and love. And, you know, because when you go to those doctor's appointments, they always want to know, are you depressed? And mm-hmm. she's like, no, not at all. And then, you know, there's also in geriatrics, it's almost the same thing that I found in special education, because you know that Nadira mm-hmm. has Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. So for years, you know, you're always fighting this, let's not teach to the diagnosis, let's teach to the person. Mm-hmm. So it's very similar in geriatrics, because it's just this idea that, you know, these seniors are loop-de-loo, and, you know, as my mother is a person with multiple degrees, it's had a very active religious life, a very active, what do you call it when you go to work?
Career?
Career, right, exactly. Yes, she's, you know, had a very active career. And she's always worked in places where she's loved the environment, or she's always been able to take something of value. Mm-hmm. I mean, even her early jobs, you know, before marriage and while she was a student. So she gets into a doctor's office and they say things like, how's your poop and pee? So, of course, then her response is, poop and pee. And exactly what would that be? Because she resents it. And I understand yeah. it. You know, I yeah. resent it for her. So, yeah. Yeah, so that's our dynamic. It's Nadira and my mom. And yeah. then I'm just like this. I'm really like I'm the servant. You know, and then we have three cats. So all I do is I clean litter boxes. I put food out for the cats. I put food out for,
for the other inhabitants.
Nadira cooks. Yes. She likes to cook, and she watches cooking shows. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's very much in control of what goes on with my mother. Mm-hmm. You know, she organizes her medications, my mother's mm-hmm. meds. Mm-hmm. And if I go into, I'll give it to her.
Yeah.
I'll give grandma her medication. Yeah. I'm like, okay, fine.
Yeah. So you're, yeah. I think it's just so interesting because it's, you're like, you've used your mom, used is a bad word, but you have gotten inspiration from your mom and from her memories and her history and her dress and things
right.
like that so much for your intellectual life as well as your creative life. And you're like this keeper of stories in a lot of ways too. So you have her generation and then you have you and then you have Nadira. So how does Nadira fit, like how does she relate to all of this history and all the things that you work on and talk about?
Right now, Nadira is really obsessed with Bumi's career. Mm. So she could tell you a lot more.
Yeah.
I mean, she looks at Bumi's website. She watches all of Bumi's artist talks.
Yeah.
So she's very interested in that because mm-hmm. Bumi is her sister.
Right.
That's the kinship that they have.
But the other day,
I guess in talking about Christmas and, you know, my parents always had a Christmas brunch, like our whole lives there was a Christmas brunch, and it would just, it grew over the years. You know, I would bring friends home from college and my sister would bring friends home and then their parents would start coming and the neighbors were always there. So it was always, you know, the neighborhood dads back then would put together all the bicycles and they would have a Christmas Eve drink and, you know, the mailman would come in and have a drink and the garbage men would stop the trucks and, you know, get their envelopes and, you know, you'd give them fruitcakes or whatever. So,
but Nadira remembers the Christmas brunch downstairs, like she remembers because she said something about it the other day, and it's the first time she's really talked about memory. You know, she said, oh, I know when Grandpa was alive and we had, you know, we would have Christmas downstairs. Well, I thought that was interesting, you know, that she's starting to think in terms of memory.
But she hadn't really been doing that before.
Not a lot. I mean, when she hears music, you know, my dad was a huge jazz aficionado. So when she hears jazz, she's like, oh, or she used to say it, oh, Grandpa, that's jazz. Grandpa listened to that. You know, that's, Grandpa loved that. But beyond that, she really is in the present. Yeah, she's very much in the present. Now she also but she also does have a memory of buildings, because when we were, once we were in Montreal, and I said, "Oh, look at the buildings. This reminds me of France," and she's like, "No, this is like Belgium." I'm like, "Oh, okay."
Whoa.
Yeah. And so she does. You know, she's been to Boston and other you know, cities in California. So she does. She also pays attention, you know, to what the physical environment looks like and makes comparisons on occasion. You know, this is not like an ongoing conversation, but on occasion she'll make those connections.